accession number 23100, reel 7.
As long as the screen is unfolding,
let
it run.
Right, so you were saying about being asked to look for this this wireless station.
Yes, and suddenly John sent a phone to say, oh, we have discovered Belhaven School, where the octu was, where I was to be sent off by Elizabeth. They've taken over Belhaven School, and that came under me too. But by this time, Lakin has had his colostomy, and he was eased in some way, some of his responsibilities, and he came up to Edinburgh and became SOE's contact in Edinburgh in an office in a lovely crescent, Rossi Terrace in Edinburgh. Beautiful Victorian houses, solid mahogany walls and doors and everything else. And he installed himself there, but he brought with him 6 NCOs and Flight Lieutenant the Honourable Jock Leslie, who was the second son of the Earl of Rosses. And Jock and his wife Coral, they managed to get a place at Balerno, or maybe they had it before, I don't know. But anyhow, they had a place at Balerno where GHF Lakin homed up for a wee while. Somehow or other they, they didn't work. And Jock Leslie was there as sort of junior officer in charge, while Lakin perambulated around various places. And he kept quite close touch with Scottish Command and D.P. Spence, Sir Patrick. And he came up to Inverlair, of course, he came up from London regularly. He'd a fondness for Inverlair F.E.O. He felt at home there more than in Group A.
From what you've said, I also got the impression that you and he had developed.
Well, we became reasonably close. He knew my background, and he wanted to know all about me, what I was doing, where I wasn't, and so on. Why was I here? I couldn't tell him. I could have said to him, hell, you bloody well vetted me, didn't you? But I didn't. No, we became quite close. He, on that second matter of indiscipline, when I, according to Peter Lee, overstepped the bounds of authority in every shape and form, you liable to a court martial, and I rang the general and asked for an appointment. And he said, no, you're not coming down here for it. He asked what it was about, and I said, I've given a report, and I've dealt with this as I think it should be dealt with. I'm sitting here on this powder keg, sir, and I've got to be seen to exert discipline and to see that it is seen to be exerted. Dude, said, this man broke government property just outside my office, apart from striking a superior officer. And I said, if this thing spreads through the house, it'll be bedlam. Look, fire, you're not coming down to see me. It was more or less his comment. I said, I'll talk to Peter Lee. No need to come down here. Listen, Fife, I was only a captain. Listen, Fife, if you get a case like this again, in any shape or form, and you have to put it in paper, you sign it Captain 4MG. You understand what it means? I said, yes, sir. It means that you are taking, if I may say so, a hell of a chance. He said, I'm quite prepared to take that chance. You sign your letter, Captain 4MG, and what you decide in discipline matters, I will back. Is that clear? And don't you bother to come down by train to see me. I'll be up to see you someday. And that was the backing I got from Lakin.
And this is over your imprisonment of this inmate that...
Dutchman.
Mm-hmm. I would have imagined that that Baker Street's pronouncement of your decision would have seemed a little bit regrettable, given the fact that one assumes that Peter Lee, the security officer in Baker Street, was not fully aware of... Had he ever visited Inverlair?
He came once. Peter Lee came once. But he didn't, I think, really understand the possibilities that were inherent in a place like Inverlair, given the nationalities that were there, who sometimes were just nationally at daggers drawn, and we had to try to jolly them along together. I mean, even the Norwegians and Danes didn't always run along together. I think Lacan understood this. Maybe John Senter did. Can't talk for Roach. But I had to be seen to be the boss.
Well, I think even allowing for, even allowing for the fact that, as you said, it is not a particularly repressive regime, if there are people who are being retained there, serving there, call it what you will, in a place where they would rather be somewhere else, mm-hmm. There has to be a degree of discipline and authority.
Only when necessarily to be seen.
Present and action will be taken when it needs to be. Yes.
As Churchill said, action this day. Couldn't let it drag on. And for Peter Lee's suggestion to go to the JAG in Inverness, that was absolutely monstrously wrong. The JAG didn't know I existed. And I was supposed to go up there and tell them about this place housing men against their will, a Dutchman bashing a Belgian, and it just wasn't on.
I find that, frankly, verging on the naive. This is the Dutchman was the first of the problem.
He was the drunk as well. And he was the second one who lost the heed. His excuse was, at least the excuse when Sam Major first drew him up, was that he hadn't got his dinner. He didn't speak Scotch like that, but it was that was his complaint. He was a man who feigned sickness every so often. And this particular morning, he feigned sickness and he missed his dinner. And the Belgian was mess orderly that day in the men's canteen. And he just came downstairs and bashed the Belgian, just like that. Without any explanation, just bashed him. And then, of course, he was restrained by the others standing around. And then the flicker outside the mess in my office at lunchtime when he was breaking the walls. But he was the only bad egg, semi-bad egg, in the place. And then Carney with his holding the babies up. But these were the only problems I ever had.
Well, I think that's remarkable, given that.
Well, I think we managed to. Vass was a great help, my adjutant. Very fatherly figure, and I had a great deal of us. When I was away on that Worsby at Waterleaton Manor, I was away for 3 weeks, and I went back and took the train up on Friday night and stayed Saturday at Inverdale just to see there was no problem. But Vass ran the place like clockwork.
How often were you away when you were Commandant?
I was away regularly. I left Inverlair at 3 o'clock on a Monday morning in time to get the Milk Run ferry from North Queens Ferry, which I usually did get, and that meant I could be in my Edinburgh office before 7 o'clock. But I had a bath and shave and I had a bit of breakfast, and I spent that day in Edinburgh contacting, if necessary, Scottish Command, contacting also Belhaven School. I had NCOs there who were doing that job there anyway. And Jock Lacey had gone by this time, and he was replaced by Martin, Bill Martin, who appears on the photograph. He succeeded Vass as adjutant because we'd closed the Edinburgh office by then. The security paper says a wrong date. He actually came in November, not to the date they gave. He was there, and I would go down there. I would sometimes stay overnight, either in the office, or sometimes Martin invited me home. He had a he and his wife and two children had managed to acquire a bungalow on Queen's Ferry Road, and I stayed once or twice by invitation with them, but I preferred not to actually. And then on Tuesday I went north and went to Aviemore, checked things there, and if they were having an exercise, a night exercise on the Wednesday or the Thursday, I would take part in that. And depending on which night it was, I would go up to Ballina, to Burghead, and check the Paranaval station, and then I would get back to Inverlair on Thursday night. And on Friday, I went up to Arisaig to do the Arisaig round, and I had CO's parade on Saturday morning, and sometimes I used to have a church parade every so often in Tomenifig Parish, which I didn't take myself. I've been ostentatious, but I allowed Vass to take the parade down to the kirk, and these boys came along quite willingly, attended church every so often. But that was my routine latterly. Each week was fully occupied. Once we got the CSO, MO1SP business established, Chief Security Liaison Officer, MO1SP, established for Scotland, I had a lot of extra work to do. I was constantly on the move, particularly for the Aviemore lot.
These are the Norwegians, mm-hmm. from which, who seem to, from my limited knowledge, are maintaining a paramilitary military series of activities from which individuals are extracted for more clandestine tasks. Mm-hmm. Would that be?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they were good. I think I told you about that trip down in the Corvette when the skipper said, "Are these deaf mutes?" They were so absolutely silent.
We should have this for the record, I think.
Oh no.
Well, I think it's an interesting indication of the calibre of those Norwegians who were...
Well, in contradistinction to the commandos, it's perhaps worth mentioning.
Yes.
Because they were regarded. The Navy did a lot of commando work, and this was just another commando exercise, did the use of a boat. This was an exercise, cross-country from the Morven coast up over the mountains and down to a point on Loch Eel, which was a sea loch, in which there were moored three Royal Navy ammunition depot ships. The Norwegians were asked to form up a party of 28 men, and they were to attack these vessels. Apart from the actual attack, there was no further proceeding, no development after that. They were just to seize the vessels. They weren't to take the sea or anything, but they were to seize the vessels, as they did with ships in Norway themselves, but of course they brought them back. But this was simply an exercise in that kind of approach and seizure. And I was asked later on with the Royal Navy to ask for a corvette on such and such a date, and on the due date I was picked up by the commandant of the Aviemore complex, Charles Hampton, taken into Fort William, because I would have to send my transport back if I took my car, take a driver with me, didn't want that. And then we got into Fort William, got down to the pier where the corvette was tied up, and within the next 20 minutes or half an hour, two trucks came from Aviemore with 28 men and Captain Joe Adamson, diminutive little man who was a banker in civil life and who died not so long ago. There's a photograph of him, and I have a complete dossier on a Norwegian reunion over there. Joe appears, but he was in command of the party, and he'd been already on a recce and had arranged with the gamekeeper of the estate to provide accommodation in Habarum for the 28 men, and also to provide a meal. And he had a haunch of venison by the time we arrived, cooking, and a large boiler, old-fashioned wash boiler of soup as well. But that's beside the point. We are not embarked yet. These troops arrived, disembarked in the two 1,500-weight trucks, formed up in small parties of seven, and they were accompanied by Captain Thompson, P.H. Thompson, who was the training officer at Aviemore, and he and I were to accompany the party as umpires. So we boarded the corvette, and these men stood in four groups of seven, standing quietly to, not to attention, but standing quietly at ease. We went aboard, and at a given signal, the skipper moved off, moved down the loch to the narrows, got through the narrows safely, proceeded further down, up to Solomon Point, and then the vessel hove to. And the Navy men lowered the boat, and they lowered also a stairway, not a rope ladder, but a stairway. And the first party, with Joe Edmondson, went off. In other words, there were seven and an officer went off, and they went quietly down the stairway. They got aboard. There were two Navy men there as well in the stern, because they were to bring the boat back under outboard motor. Our men sat two by two by two, each holding an oar, to attention. There was no noise, no slapping an oar against the corvette sides, stood silently to attention. There must have been a whispered command, because those on the vessel's side lowered their oars and pushed off. And when the boat was sufficiently far from the vessel's side, all six oars dipped very quietly into the water and pulled away without catching crabs or splashes or anything at all. Utter silence, disappeared into the night. And that was that. The first thing we heard was a pop, 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 pop of the boat coming back under power, and they tied up at the gangway. Number two party, quietly down the gangway, aboard again, sat to attention, again, the inside oars pushed off, again, all oars dipped, away they went, very quietly, not a sound. Again, the first thing we heard was pop, 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 pop. And at this point, the skipper came over to me and said, "Excuse me, sir, this is a commando job." I said, "Well, we're on an exercise." He said, "Are these men deaf mutes?" I said, "No, why is your..." Well, he said, they haven't said a word since they came aboard. Now, he said, I've ferried commandos. They tell dirty stories, they smoke cigarettes, they drop the butts on my deck, and they grind it into the deck. And he said, they spit on my deck too. But these fellows haven't opened their mouths, even among themselves. I said, "No, they're not deaf mutes, but they're pretty highly." And he said, "There they go." They go down and they stand, sit oars to attention. They push off without a dunt. And they row away without a splash. He said, "Well, I've never seen this." I said, "Well, we just have them very highly trained." So the boat came back. The third party went aboard. Again, same procedure. Quietly pushed off into the night. And he came back to me and he said, "Excuse me, sir, would you mind if I put an Aldous lamp on that? Because I was..." He said, "This is intriguing." I said, "No, an Aldous lamp won't do any harm as far as we're concerned." So he got his Aldous lamp and he tracked what he thought was the course of the boat. There was no boat to be seen. And eventually he did find it, but at that point his Navy were pushing off. And the last of our Joes was clambering up the rocks the side of the shore. And the boat came back, and then I went off with the fourth party with Tommy Thompson, and that was that. We shook hands with Christmas, the lieutenant, as we left, went down his gangway, and we went over the mountains to this gamekeeper's bothy, and we had a wonderful meal. The men were housed in one of his barns. And then Tommy and I were to act as umpires, and we were going off in the morning. The party was leaving at 7 o'clock. to go over the top. It wasn't all, it was 3,000 feet, but it wasn't sort of rock climbing and scaling. You could walk all the way, or climb all the way. And Tommy and I were up on the old Northern Road as far as Cronin, and then we would go up the glen by a much less hazardous route, but it was wet, damn wet. And we reached the point on our hillside. We reached the point on our hillside about quarter to twelve, were we, I think. We didn't expect the forward party, the scouting party, till about 1 o'clock, because it's a long way, and we didn't expect the full party until afternoon, because there was no great urgency, no great rush. The exercise wasn't night, and there was no need for them to be on the lock side in daylight. So we eventually got to our rendezvous on a bridge. A wee burn came down the hill and this bridge, and Tommy and I stopped and we took off our boots and emptied out the water that was there because we were soaked. Fording is not the right word. We had to plough through these damn streams that morning, and we emptied our boots. We took off our socks, wrung them out, slapped them on the parapet, left them to dry for a while, it was sunny, and chatted for a wee while. Again, I got the glasses out. Far too early. Not here yet. And then we put on our boots. I think we had a cup of coffee out of a thermos. We put on our socks and boots, and we walked along half a mile to check that the two dinghies were actually hidden in the bushes for the takeoff point. Came back to the bridge, and we had a back sandwich, which we had, and suddenly we had footsteps at our back. Turned out, and here was the scouting party. And we said, "Of course, you've made good time. You've made very good time. Been here, sir, for some time." We said, "You can't have been, because, damn it all, you must have been running all the way." I said, "No, sir. You arrived, sir, at 11:45. "How do you know?" I said, "We were up there. We watched you." I said, "You can't have been. It's not." He said, "Look, sir, you and Captain Thompson took off your boots, emptied out the water, took off your socks, squeezed them out, buttered them on the bridge. Eventually, you recover something, put on your socks and your boots, walked along there for a little way. We lost sight of you amongst the trees. You came back, and here you are, sir. You were here at 11:45, sir." These were the kinds of people we had. And they came along in the afternoon, quite early, but they tucked themselves away, they got tucked out of the way, and it was to be a night assault on the three vessels. It was a moonlight night, unfortunately, in a way, but it was cloudy. And they set off with these two dinghies, and they clambered up the anchor chains of two of the vessels, and that was that. The Navy wasn't pleased.
Had the Navy been advised that they were going to be attacked?
Or? Oh, yes, yes, but it was very hush-hush. Only certain people, only the commanding people were warned about this. I mean, we didn't tell the ratings. The place was only under guard, these vessels, only under guard, limited guard, because there was no apparent danger of attack for them. They might have been bombed with the Luftwaffe knew about them, but no matter how many men you had on board, it wouldn't help. But no, the man in charge of the vessels, but he kept out of the way until he found he was under guard.
Because I mean, you must, given the fact that you were undergoing these exercises and so on, I mean, your own physical stamina and strength must have been quite advanced at this time.
Oh, look, Simon Vass and I kept ourselves fit. We went out shooting every night over the mountains for rabbits, because our rations were extra rations, because we had foreign troops under our command, and foreign troops got more rations than the British troops. But they got almost a loaf of bread a day by regulation, and we extra bits and pieces here and there, which annoyed an incoming new commanding officer of the RASC. That's a story. It's a man. I knew the man. He didn't know me, and I didn't know him at the time, but I knew who he was. He came in, and he sent my ration truck off or back without rations. And Copperbet came back, reported to the adjutant, no rations, sir. Wasn't allowed any. Why? Because he said we're asking more than we're entitled to. So Vasquez on the phone and said that, and the commanding officer said, you're not entitled to these rations, and that's that. Send me a proper requisition, and you'll get your rations. More or less, hell with you. So I'd been away, and I came back just after Vasquez was on the phone. And he said, that new commanding officer's refused us our rations. So, why? Oh, well, Bet was in, and Bet was turned away. And he said, I've just been on the phone, and I've been told to get a flea in my lug, and that's that. So I said, well, I rang up. And I said, there's a commandant in Verlier here, I want to speak to your commanding officer, whoever he may be. He's out somewhere around. I said, go and find him. I want to see him, speak to him urgently. So go and find him now. And this is Commandant in Verlier speaking. So whoever was at the other end put down the phone anyhow. And eventually, after several minutes, a voice came on the phone. Commandant RESC. I said, yes, well, this is a commandant. You've sent my ration track back empty-handed. Did you read your marching orders when you took over last week? Who are you? I said, I'm Commandant Inverlier. I'm asking you, did you read your marching orders? Your marching in orders when you came in? I don't understand. I said, you've sent my truck back empty-handed, and I'm perfectly entitled to the rations on that requisition list. And I said, I'm sending my driver in now, and he'd better come back with my full rations or you won't be in a job next week. I can tell you that. Because you don't know what you're doing. We did get the rations. But it turned out that he was a man whom I knew by repute. He was actually managing director of Pringles, the knitwear people. And of course, I came across him later on. I never actually told Willie that he was a little pipsqueak who refused me rations. But, that was the odd thing about the rations. We had this extra entitlement, but over and above that, Vass and I went out each night, and the place was littered. We didn't shoot, never shot deer. I once shot a woodcock, but nothing else. Grouse I didn't touch because that really was out with our remit, really. We weren't supposed to be poaching. But I did clear the rabbits, the Vass and I. We had each a 2-2, and we weren't shooting rabbits with 2-2s. And Rosa was able to disguise rabbit meat in such a way that it looked like all sorts of other things after a few weeks.
Did you do much fishing?
No, I didn't fish at all. No. The Spion is a salmon river, but we didn't fish. The men, the foreigners, used to go down along the gorge and come back with dozens and dozens of seagull's eggs, which made an excellent, if rather strong, omelette, which Rosa was able to doctor up too.
I mentioned about your own fitness and so on. Did you ever wish to take on a more operational role?
I did want to go with the Norwegians, because I was allied closely to them, and I'd gone to London, of course. In the meantime, you see, I'd closed in, at least I didn't close in Verlier, I left in Verlier to London. And before I left, I said to Charles Hampton, when the time comes for you to take on the Norwegian job, will you include me in your party? I was very glad to do so. I said, you'll have to talk to Jack Wilson. He was head of the Norwegian section, you know. So when I got to London, I spoke to Jack Wilson, and I said, I'd very much like to go, I didn't tell anybody else, with Charles Hampton's party when he goes. Because after I've been tied with him for quite a long time, very good English, yes, I'll make a note of that. I said, you'll have to talk to, here comes Earl Boyle. It must come from you, not from me. You want me. If you want me, I have to come from you. All right, give it to me. And I thought that was all fixed. And Charles Hampton, in due time, set up his formation, and Wilson has forgotten to talk to Bugsy Boyle. And I missed that show altogether. And I was very sorry about that, because I would have loved to go for that party. But, again, I might not have been allowed to, because I was asked if I would join a party, if I would go to Yugoslavia. And I said, yes, but I've no German. I've no Croat, or Serbo-Croat. Your German's good enough to get you by. I said, right, Archie Fiedler. But there was a very strong regulation in SOE